The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to Nobody Told Me. I'm Jan Black.
And I'm Laura Owens.
Have you ever thought about what you see when you walk around your neighborhood? Have you ever wondered about the stories behind things like bike lanes, stoplights, sidewalks, recycling bins, and mailboxes?
Our guest on this episode is best-selling author and journalist Spike Carlson, who's written a fascinating new book called A Walk Around the Block: Stoplight Secrets, Mysterious Squirrels, Manhole Mysteries, and other stuff you see every day and know nothing about. Spike, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Pleasure to be with you.
You've written a lot of books before, but nothing like this one. So what inspired you to write it, and why is right now the perfect time to read it?
Oh, yeah, that's great. Well, I was always been the curious sort. I was the kid who took apart the lawnmower to try to make a go-kart when I was a kid. And then I went into teaching, and that is, teaching people about the world around. And I went into construction, and in that world, you just have to figure out, you know, how the world around you works. I became an editor with Family Handyman magazine, which basically was teaching readers, how the world and the things inside their homework. And then I started writing books, and, you know, prompted by a frozen water pipe, I decided to tackle this. We know how the pyramids were built 4,000 years ago, and we talk about how we're going to colonize Mars, 100 years down the road, but we don't know much about the world right outside our front door. And so I started looking into that, and it's a world of mystery, history, and intrigue. And so I wrote a book about it. And in terms of the timing, it's just turned out to be, I'm not sure what the word is, propitious, in that there's so many more people walking these days. There's so many benefits to walking. And, of course, when I started this book, the whole pandemic thing wasn't on anyone's radar. And so it's actually turned out to be pretty timely that just as people are walking more, this book would come out.
Is the way you view A Walk Around the Block now different from what it was when you started this project
pre-pandemic?
There's a new term out there, and it's called awe walking. It's based on a study done in Sweden where they had two groups of people walk an extra 15 minutes a day, and one group just walked, and another group walked with an increased awareness of nature and the things around them. And they found that people that walked with a purpose and with a focus had a better sense of well-being. They felt more refreshed. They felt more socially connected. And so I think that the world outside our door is kind of a museum. And it's, it has history, and it has art, and it has people involved. And it's just like going to an art gallery. When you know more about the painting, you can appreciate it more. And I think knowing more about fire hydrants and utility poles and concrete and trees and squirrels, knowing the history and the stories behind those things, it can make a walk a lot more interesting. So I think that's how it's changed my walk around the block.
When I first heard about the book, I was thinking to myself how I feel guilty that I spend all this time mindlessly researching random things on my phone when I'm bored, and it has nothing to do with the world around me. Why is it that we do that instead of caring about what's right in front of us?
Yeah, I just think it has to do with, generally the way people think. When people think about walking, they think about physical exercise. But I think when you really look at it, it's about social exercise and mental exercise and, you know, connecting with the people you might walk with. And really, you know, just in terms of walking, putting away the electronics and focusing about the world around you can, it's just a nice break from the electronic world that we're increasingly living in.
You know, my sense is that we all tend to focus on different things when we take a walk. And I say that because I know when Laura and my other daughter, Sarah, were younger and we would take a walk, the things that they noticed were completely different from what I noticed. And it was wonderful because it was like seeing the world with new eyes. And when I take a walk with my husband, the things that he notices are different from the things that I notice, which is really kind of interesting to me.
Yeah, I mean, my wife really hesitates to walk with me these days because I'm constantly looking at, you know, the birthmark on utility poles, and I'm explaining different things about trees and squirrels. But like I say, it's a museum out there, and you know, if this book can kind of act as a guide to that museum, you know, we delve into history, the story of things is really the story of people and their successes and their failures and their inventiveness. And, you know, kind of getting those deep stories, I think, can give people a real appreciation for the stuff we take for granted. You know, one of the things that really got this book off the mark was we had a frozen water line into our house, you know, something we all take for granted. And it took a couple of days to get the water up and running again. And part of the long-term solution was to let water run in the sink for the next 6 weeks so that the line wouldn't freeze up again. Mm-hmm. And so for 6 weeks, I got to thinking, you know, where does that water come from? And where does that water go? And how did my call to the water department, you know, get to the water department? And, you know, it just got me to thinking about all the things around us that we take for granted. And it really was a great fun book to write, and met so many interesting people and had a lot of interesting experiences.
Yeah, not even just the things we take for granted. Like you said, the people we take for granted who have such a big part in making these things. You were lucky enough to travel all around the world to meet people who do random jobs that are really important and they have really interesting stories. What were the most interesting ones to you?
You know, you mentioned the essential personnel that we don't honor enough, I would say. You know, there's no on-off switch at the sewage treatment plant or the water purification facility or the electrical plant, you know, so they're really kind of unsung heroes. The same with, you know, trash and recycling collection and mail carriers, you know, those are some of the most dangerous jobs in the United States, and we don't recognize those people. So I really wanted to cover, you know, those things in terms of kind of good stories. When I was in Paris, I was researching graffiti, and I had lined up a meeting with Irvin, a local graffiti artist, and I had my little tape recorder and pad and pencil and list of questions. And rather than sitting down and interviewing, he said, come on, let's go paint. And so we went into the back alleyway behind the bar where we were going to meet, and we painted for a couple hours. And in the course of that couple hours, it covered all the questions that I had. People stopped and asked more questions. You kind of get a sense of why people do what they do and who they are. And so that was one of the more, you know, for a writer, that's kind of a gift to have someone come up and suggest ways where you can get dirt under your fingernails to get the real story. You know, other things I did was I wanted to cover pigeons because they're kind of a rural, suburban, and urban critter that most people can relate to. And it's so hard to interview pigeons, but I interviewed a pigeon racer. And I spent 3 days with him, and we went through training and then an actual race. He had 240 pigeons. And again, it's, you know, in the course of that, you learn about, of course, you know, racing pigeons, but you also learn about the history behind pigeons and, you know, the worldwide history of pigeons and, you know, the story behind the demise of the passenger pigeon. So that was another really nice, gritty story to get involved with. I did a section on litter and roadkill. And the more I got into the roadkill, the more I became fascinated with it. And I was down in down south interviewing Heather Montgomery, who had written a book on roadkill. Fascinating woman, fascinating topic. And while I was down there, I wound up being a judge for the Marlinton, West Virginia roadkill cookoff, which is the 16th cookoff. And so again, it sounds kind of zany, and people go, "What is there to learn about roadkill?" But there's, you know, so much we can do in terms of, you know, when we travel and understanding animal behavior and that type of thing, you know, to kind of minimize the dangers to those animals and to us. So, you know, those were just a few of the more interesting interviews. I spent some time with Nelson Molina of the Trash Museum in New York City. He was a trash collector for, I think, almost 30 years. And over the course of that, he accumulated around 45,000 treasures from the trash. And so it was everything from signed photos of Jackie Kennedy to pieces of the World Trade Center to Fender guitars. And again, you know, you can just write about trash, and there's a lot of fascinating statistics, but you want to bring in the human element. And by doing that, I think you're able to draw more people into the story.
We're glad to have you as part of our Nobody Told Me family of listeners, and we're excited to share information with you about our sponsor, Athletic Greens.
I started taking Athletic Greens because I wanted to know what all the hype was about. I have friends and family members who told me how great it is, and you know what? They're right. My older daughter, Sarah, Laura's older sister, is a big fan of Athletic Greens. Right, Sarah?
Very true. My husband and I were looking for an affordable supplement that would offer a lot of health benefits without a lot of hassle, which is why we were so excited to find Athletic Greens AG1. I just mix one scoop of Athletic Greens AG1 with a glass of water every morning and drink up. I'm absorbing 75 high-quality vitamins, minerals, whole food-sourced superfoods, probiotics, and adaptogens.
This special blend of ingredients supports your gut health, nervous system, immune system, energy, recovery, focus, and aging. And it has this kind of mild, tropical taste that, like my mom and sister, I look forward to every day. Athletic Greens uses the best of the best products based on the latest science with constant product iterations. In fact, the current AG1 formula is the 52nd version that's been developed.
It costs less than $3 a day, which is a lot less than you'd pay if you bought all of these ingredients yourself. Athletic Greens has over 7,000 five-star reviews in addition to ours. And right now, it's time to reclaim your health and arm your immune system with convenient daily nutrition, especially in the flu and cold season.
It's just one scoop and a cup of water every day. That's it. No need for a million different pills and supplements to look out for your health.
And to make it easy, Athletic Greens is going to give you a free 1-year supply of immune-supporting vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase.
All you have to do is visit athleticgreens.com/NTM.
Again, that's athleticgreens.com/NTM to take ownership over your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance.
That's athleticgreens.com/NTM.
You know, you really drew me into the story with the first chapter of the book, which is on front porches. Tell us a little bit about the story behind front porches and why they declined.
Yeah. You know, front porches used to be, you know, Facebook and Match.com and television. I mean, they were all these things rolled into one.
Yeah.
Before the advent of the internet and mass communication. And And so they were used for courting and for exchanging information and having political discussions and those types of things. And they really, you know, glowed their brightest between about 1880 and 1930. And they were more than just an architectural element. It was kind of a rebellion from standard architecture of the past. This was an American thing, and people took pride in it. And it's probably no surprise that the demise of the porch coincided with the rise of the automobile. And, you know, people, rather than sitting on the front porch to cool off or to chat, could travel to other places. And then as garages became more prevalent, people, you know, kind of moved into their backyards for entertaining. But front porches are such a great element in this day and age. They're kind of a social lubricant. They're part public, they're part private. So at least in my neighborhood, when you're out on your front porch, people are more comfortable kind of starting out with a little small talk and you know, easing into other things if you want. You know, you're outside, you're socially distanced. And so front porches are making a bit of a resurgence. I believe about 2/3 of all houses these days are built with a front porch. And I think we tend to think of them as an architectural element, but they're also a social element that just can increase our social interaction and our, you know, and enjoyment of the outdoors.
A lot of people don't want to go outdoors during the pandemic. I'm wondering what ideas you would have for them if they want to understand that sense of wonder and really get into researching their surroundings. Can they do it inside? Are there everyday objects we can look at inside and find a sense of wonder with? Like, I'm looking at antibacterial wipes right now. I can certainly find wonder in those, but in terms of the manufacturing and the story, is it the same thing?
Yeah, you know, one of the people that made the biggest impression on me was Bea Johnson. And she's kind of one of the founders. In fact, she's San Francisco-based, like you, I believe.
Yeah,
she's kind of one of the founders of the zero waste movement. And she's the woman you've maybe seen pictures of, but her family of four, all their trash for a year fits into a one-quart mason jar. And, you know, she does this by by composting, recycling, bulk buying, you know, reusing. And, you know, of course, she takes things to an extreme. But when you talk to people who take things to an extreme, you pull back a little bit and you can change your behavior that way. So it was fascinating to talk with her about trash and recycling. And, you know, that's something that everyone generates from the inside. You know, looking out the window, one of my other favorite chapters was on squirrels and their fascinating critters in terms of their their nut storage habits. And their...
Loved what you talked about with their tails.
And yeah.
The direction and everything.
Yeah, Laura and I used to take walks around the neighborhood or look in our backyard, and we'd always see squirrels. So share with us what you learned about them, because they're fascinating to us.
Yeah, well, the tails, like you say, they're kind of like a Wallenda balancing pole, and they can act as a air conditioner in summer and a little heater in the winter. And they use it as a signal to other squirrels if there's danger encroaching. You know, in the fall, you often see them, at least in the northern climates, scurrying around, burying walnuts and preparing for the winter. And it turns out, you know, there's two types of squirrels when it comes to eating habits. There's larder hoarders, where they will put all their foodstuffs in one place, and then they have to vigorously protect that. And then there's scatter hoarders, where they'll have, you know, 15 or 20 or 100 different places where they will bury their nuts. So not all their eggs are in one basket, so to speak. And people go, well, how do they remember where they bury all these goods? And they don't. They estimate they remember for about 30 minutes where they bury a nut, but they have a keen sense of smell, and they find, you know, maybe 70 or 80% of the nuts they bury. And so just the feeding habits of squirrels are fascinating. Some people will probably ask, well, if they're so interested in nuts, why are they always gnawing on my lawn furniture and on my, on my bird feeder? And the answer to that is, like all rodents, the front teeth of a squirrel continuously grow as much as 6 inches a year. And they do that because, you know, nature has provided them with extra tooth growth because they're constantly gnawing and things like that. So, you know, so a squirrel will grow 6 inches worth of incisor teeth in a year. And if they aren't constantly gnawing, their teeth can actually grow to an extent where it'll wedge their mouth open and they'll die.
Wow.
And so that's one of the, you know, kind of interesting little tidbits in the book. And, you know, I've really grown new respect for squirrels. I was able to interview Robert Lischick, a squirrel linguist from Auburn University, who studied squirrel.
What exactly is a squirrel linguist? Yeah, what an interesting job.
I know. And he's an interesting fellow. And they do have a way of communicating. And he loves sharing his research. And it's so much fun to talk to someone like that who's passionate about what they do and loves to share their information. And, you know, so everywhere from their talking habits to their storage habits, we included information like that in the book.
You also talked a lot about street names and street numbers, which I found fascinating. Shed some light on those.
And why Second Street is the most popular name.
You quiz people and a lot of people will say, you know, what's the most common name? And people will come up with Main and Park. And in some states, they're correct. But if you take it on a nationwide basis, Second Street is the number one name, primarily because Main Street will often take the place of First Street. And so even just walking around the block and looking at signs can be a little fascinating study in history, in learning the two most common alphabetical runs are trees and president names. You know, you can get a lesson in history and tree culture by doing that. I also get into other types of signs, you know, stop signs and other types of warning signs. And again, there's just a whole science behind those and how they work and why they work.
I also thought it was interesting that you talked about how the speed limit is related to stoplights and how everything is timed. I never thought about that.
Yeah, that was really a surprise to me too. You wonder about, you don't wonder about the long
one. I guess I always thought it was random, didn't you?
I never thought about it, really.
How long a stoplight stays yellow, but it turns out there's a formula. And if you take the speed limit and you divide by 10, that will give you the number of seconds that a yellow light will stay yellow. So, you know, in my neighborhood, there's actually a road where the speed limit is 65 miles an hour. And so the yellow lights there will be yellow for 6.5 seconds. If you're in a 30 mile an hour zone, normally it'll be a 3 second red light. And then in almost every case, there's an all red period where the lights will be red for 1 to 3 seconds as an extra safety precaution. And then, you know, there's those irritating preemption signals that flash above stoplights when there's an emergency vehicle coming. And they're irritating unless you're the person in the ambulance, because as it turns out, it reduces intersection collisions by somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 and 40%. And it increases response time kind of by an equal percent. So even just a simple stoplight if you look into the history and science behind it, can be pretty darn interesting.
Shed some light, if you will, on parking, what you learned about parking.
Yeah, it's an intertangled thing. And I relied on Don Shoup, the prophet of parking, for a lot of this information. It turns out there's about 8 parking spaces for every vehicle in the United States. So there's plenty of parking. And one of the things that kind of makes our cities less walkable are the standard requirements needed by restaurants and other facilities for cars. So if you're at the Olive Garden, you need to have about 8 parking spaces for every couple of tables. And what it does is it creates these huge parking lots, and then there'll be a building, and then another huge parking lot and another building. And it makes our cities less walkable and I would argue a little less interesting. There's just a lot of futuristic thinking about how parking meters at some point will be so smart that when we're going to enter an area of the city, we'll be able to find out if a parking meter is available, how much per hour it will cost. If it's a very busy time of the day, maybe it'll cost $20 an hour. If it's not busy, maybe it won't cost anything. And, you know, our smartphones will say, well, if you don't want to pay for the parking, here's where you can find a rent-a-bike, and here's when the buses is coming by, and here's how available an Uber is. And so there's lots of different, there's more and more competition for the curb these days. It's not just for parking, it's FedEx trucks, it's bike lanes, it's walking lanes. And so by rethinking parking, there are a lot of ways we can make our new cities and our old cities more walkable.
It's interesting because when I think about characteristics that people desire, I think about success. They want to be hardworking. They want to be happy. But you never think about curiosity as being something that's really important. And one thing that I really learned from your book is that curiosity makes for a more intelligent and happier person. Did you find that as well?
You know, I think so. The book has been out for about 5 weeks, and it's at a point where you start to get, you know, feedback from people. Of course, that's good and bad, but for the most part, it's been good. And a lot of people say, well, thank you for opening our eyes to the things we see around us. And like I say, walking, I believe it's around 100 million people in the United States consider walking their primary form of exercise. And it's so good because no matter if you're recovering from an injury, it doesn't matter what age you are, all you really need is a good pair of walking shoes. And it's so good for your mental health, physical health, social health, you know, health, even health of the environment. We could go in that direction too. And so the book gets a little bit into how to make our cities more walkable. And then I spent a day walking with the Nordic walking queen. When we walk, we use about 60% of our muscles. When you Nordic walk with poles, you use about 90% of your muscles.
Really?
Wow.
Yeah. And so you
use your arms more, huh?
Yeah. You look a little geekier.
Hey, but you're burning more calories, so you have the last laugh.
Yeah. Nordic walking is huge in, of course, you know, Nordic countries and in Europe. And the Nordic walking queen says one of the drawbacks here is that people think you look geeky. You know, people say, hey, did you forget your skis?
Yeah.
Or, you know, did you injure yourself? But I've taken up Nordic walking and I find it just an enjoyable way. And it's a great workout. If you're recovering from an injury, it gives you, you know, extra balance. They've used Nordic walking for people recovering from a wide variety of illnesses. And it's worth looking into.
Spike, you know, our show is called Nobody Told Me, and we always ask our guests, what is your Nobody Told Me lesson? So what is it that nobody told you about walking or the things you find in your neighborhood or life, wherever you want to take it? What's your Nobody Told Me lesson that you kind of wish someone had told you about that you otherwise wouldn't have had to learn it the hard way?
Well, this isn't life-changing, but I love trivia about fire hydrants. And for starters, if you look at the caps and the valves on a fire hydrant, they're five-sided. And that's, of course, to prevent tampering. There's very few five-sided wrenches out there. But when you dig down, you get even some better history. Right next to me right now, I have a chunk of wood water pipe from the city of Stillwater. And, you know, in early cities, all the water systems were wood. And if there was a fire, the fire personnel would dig down to these wood pipes and they would drill a hole in them. And then as that pit filled up, they would either pump or bail water out of that to take care of the fire. And when they were done, they'd place a long stick in the hole to plug that up and let it extend above ground so they could find it again. And that's kind of the origin of the name fire plug. And then because most fire departments were private, they would hire someone to kind of defend that area. And that person was plug ugly. And then the other thing is in New York, you know, you see these pictures of often New York where there's people playing in fire hydrants. And actually you can apply for a spray cap hydrant in New York City. And if the conditions are right, they'll come out and they'll put a spray cap on the fire hydrant and so that people can cool off in hot weather. And it's probably, I think, the only city in the U.S. where you can do that. But, you know, there's kind of a story behind those. So while these aren't life-changing things, if you're ever stuck in an elevator, you can really, really, you know, be the star of the show during that time.
Well, Spike, we want to thank you so much for coming on and telling us about this book. And I saw you say that it makes for perfect bathroom reading. So you don't need to read all of it at once. And I think it's just a great book for people to read and get a little bit of appreciation for life when they might need it most.
Yeah. Thanks so much for being on. This was a lot of fun.
Well, our thanks to you. This was a lot of fun. Our thanks to best-selling author Spike Carlson, whose latest book is called A Walk Around the Block, Stoplight Secrets, Mysterious Squirrels, Manhole Mysteries, and Other Stuff You See Every Day and Know Nothing About. His website is spikecarlson.com. I'm Jan Black.
And I'm Laura Owens.
You're listening to Nobody Told Me. Thank you so much for joining us.